Yo, what is a cipher?
It seems that the golden era has really stuck to these people.
You. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sitaro. This is episode 102, a talk with Miami's mixtape king, DJ EFN. Since the early 1990s, EFN has been a major player in Miami's hip-hop scene as a mixtape DJ, marketing guru, clothing store owner, manager, website owner, and more. Most recently, he's become a documentary filmmaker with three entries in his Coming Home series about hip-hop scenes in foreign countries. His latest album, Another Time, features an incredibly disparate crew of rappers, including Bun B, Killer Mike, and Redman. For more information about this show, including a list of the tracks we play, or to hear any of our other episodes, you can visit us online at thecyphershow.com. If you enjoy The Cipher, help make sure it continues by supporting us at patreon.com/thecyphershow. We even have special rewards and experiences for our supporters. Also, make sure to visit us on iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe to the show so you'll never miss an episode. The more 5-star ratings we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests. And now, here's hip-hop's Anthony Bourdain, DJ EFN. So you said, you know, you're working on getting the Coming Home movie to Revolt. You did Coming Home Cuba, which is a documentary about you, you know, going to Cuba and the hip-hop scene there.
My name is Garcia. That's me at the airport, looking self-absorbed and stressed out, waiting to get on the plane. A plane that'll take me and my boys on a trip to Havana, Cuba. Sounds dope, right?
Is that the one that you're turning into them? Because I think they broadcast that one before, right?
Yeah, no, Coming Home Cuba was the first one that they had already picked up. We filmed that in 2012, and they got picked up by them in 2013. And it's been airing ever since beginning of last year. And right now, the next two installments are Coming Home Peru and Coming Home Haiti, which we're currently editing and finishing up Coming Home Haiti. Both will be airing on Revolt.
That's incredible. And both those have been filmed already?
Yeah. We filmed both of them already. We're done with Peru. I'm turning that in. It's supposed to premiere on Revolt, hopefully next month. And then Haiti's on track for May, which is actually Haitian Heritage Month. And so we're currently editing Haiti.
You know, for people who don't know or haven't seen Coming Home Cuba, that was a very personal project for you, right? Like, you're Cuban. A lot of your family, you know, obviously has very, very intense feelings about Cuba and the revolution. And it was about you kind of going there and connecting with the hip hop scene there.
Correct. I'm Cuban American. I'm originally born in Los Angeles, California, moved to Miami, Florida at a young age. And if people don't know about the dynamic of especially Cuban Americans in Miami, and it's generally any Cuban Americans or Cubans in the United States, they're very, you know, they have a lot of passion and very opinionated about, you know, Cuba and the politics that have to do with Cuba, and they're very proactive in it. So we're kind of raised as Cuban Americans that you don't do anything having to do with the Cuban government or Cuba as a country, because they feel that if you travel there, you do anything there, you're contributing towards the Castro regime. So it's pretty taboo to travel to Cuba as a Cuban American. And in some instances in the past, it can get you a lot of harassment and even some violent acts towards you, because it's so much passion having to do with that topic.
But in very slowly in recent years, it seems like, you know, the attitudes of kind of the older generation in Miami have slowly fallen out of step with a lot of the rest of the country.
Right. I mean, what's happened is that the older generation, it's just nature. They're dying out. and their stranglehold on the politics is starting to die out, and the younger generation is starting to realize, first of all, A, they don't have the same baggage, and B, they're just saying to themselves, well, this embargo that's been in place for decades has not changed anything, so maybe we should try a different approach. But people don't realize the stranglehold that Cuban Americans have on the politics of Florida, therefore having huge implications on the politics of the entire United States through the electoral votes and all that. And that's why Florida's always cast it in a negative light, because, and it has a lot to do, unfortunately, with my Cuban people.
And so, but now you're making a film that in some sense is like less immediately personal to you about the hip hop scene in other countries, right? With Peru and Haiti.
Correct. When we did Coming Home Cuba, I'm not a filmmaker per se. I didn't go into that thinking, oh, I'm going to make films. I knew I always wanted to go to Cuba. I definitely wanted to go before things changed drastically, because I knew it was in a time capsule, and I felt I wanted to see it somewhat of what my parents kind of saw it and my grandparents. And I wanted to go before there was a Taco Bell and McDonald's on every corner.
Right.
So that was, I had an urgency of going at the point where I finally went. I was like, who cares? Who gets mad at me? I'm just going to go. And I wanted to film the entire experience. And while I was there, I was like, let me just link with the hip hop artists. And if I film it, you know, I'm not trying to do anything political. I'm just going to stick to just linking with the people and trying to talk about something that we have in common, which was hip hop. So when we came back and we put together this film, very amateur, and we started showing it to people, and we got picked up by some small film festivals, and we won some film festival awards, people started to give us this feedback. And I originally thought only Cubans and Cuban Americans and maybe people in Miami who have been around Cubans would care about the film. But it turned out that a lot of people thought it was interesting, and a lot of people came up to me and said, man, you're inspiring me to want to go back to my parents' homeland or where I'm originally from, or explore my roots. And that gave me the idea of, man, I would love to see other, you know, I love to travel, so I would love to go to other countries and explore these countries through the scope of hip hop culture. So basically, like a hip hop Anthony Bourdain is what I'm trying to do.
Amazing. So why Haiti?
Oh, well, Haiti was easy. It was always going to be in the top of my list. I'm sticking to, like, the first couple of countries are things that are interesting to me or a part of my like just the culture in Miami or my upbringing. So
sure, Miami, of course, like, you know, huge Haitian population, a whole neighborhood called Little Haiti.
Little Haiti, exactly. I have in my crew, Crazy Hood Productions, and my group of friends, there's Haitians, there's Jamaicans. So and you know, I've side by side with Haitians. So and Haiti, just like Cuba, is very taboo in a different kind of way, though. It's very taboo to travel there. People are like, oh, I don't know about going to Haiti. That's kind of scary. So that's the type of places that I want to visit first, the places that people usually don't want to travel. And then I want to go and connect where people don't think there's hip hop culture there. And I mean, there's going to be rappers most likely anywhere, but I'm trying to show more of the culture. I want to look for B-boys and DJs and graph writers and all of that stuff. And people don't think of these type of things in these countries. And I want to go and show you, like, wow, look. And then it's kind of something that, like, bridges the gap where people here can relate to that. And then it's like a common language that we're speaking.
Yeah. And the interesting thing I think you found in Cuba and I assume found in other places is, like, their version of hip hop and hip hop culture is closer to what we would think of as kind of like the golden age here, right? In terms of, like, aesthetics and what the scene is and what the community is.
Correct. They, for obvious reasons, they definitely identify to the whole political side of hip hop from, like, the 90s era, like Public Enemy and stuff like that. And the you know, just the whole Afrocentric era. We have to remember that a lot of there's Black Panthers that were given political asylum in Cuba. And those Black Panthers, which includes Tupac's aunt.
Mm-hmm. Asada, yeah.
Right. They are kind of like, they went ahead and became very proactive in Cuba and were part of bringing a lot of hip hop and shining the light on hip hop for Cubans and exposing them to certain kinds of hip hop. So you see that influence on hip hop there today. And a lot of in the other countries I've traveled to, it seems that the golden era has really stuck to these people, and it's something that they it really resonated with them. But I'm also seeing, because of the internet and because of technology slowly creeping in now, is the newer hip hop culture, and they're starting to become a clash. But a common theme that I've found so far in the three countries that we've done the films in is that all three countries, people have asked us, what happened to you guys in the U.S.? Why did you guys lose, you know, the essence of hip hop culture? When did you guys sell out? Like, what made you guys sell out, basically?
That's really, really interesting. Yeah. And Peru is an interesting place. Politically, it's been very volatile for a long time. You know, I know obviously like there was rebellions happening there, and then kind of government crackdowns, you know, as a result of the rebellions and so forth. Like, when you were there, did you get a sense of what the political climate was like there right now?
It seemed a little stable, but we did get a good lesson on stuff that had been going on recently. They have what they called their terrorists or terrorism. Episodes of terrorism, which isn't the same as us having to deal with all the Islamic terrorism. They had different rebel groups and political groups that had infighting. And I didn't know about that. So it was new to me. And they were showing us different like areas where there were like these battles or there was terrorist acts that had happened. But while we were there, it seemed like it was pretty stable. And from what we spoke to people, politically, they were stable, but very poor in terms of the majority of the country is still a very poor country, and they have a lot of issues with between the natives, that the people that are descended from the Incas and other native cultures that were there before, and the Spaniards, and they have like this classism that still goes on to this day.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing. What was the music scene like there?
It was really dope. I mean, the first day we were there, we went to a block party that had like a bunch of MCs and freestyle battles and b-boys. And one of the things that stood out of Peru is that they have a huge freestyle scene. So they're really into just freestyling and stuff and battling, battle rap. So, and the reason for that made sense to me is that they don't have an infrastructure to promote their hip hop scene. So they don't have radio stations.
There's not recorded music in the
Exactly. It's not easy for them to record. It's not easy. If they did record it, it's not easy for them to get it out. They don't have even regular club nights for to listen to and dance to hip hop or do whatever. So to them, it's easier to just go out on the block and just battle each other and get props that way amongst their peers. And that seemed to be the most popular form of hip hop over there.
Interesting. And the relationship between, American hip hop and the rest of the world is, obviously huge and fascinating, but like it goes on a really long time. In a lot of ways, people were fucking with like hip hop culture in France before a lot of people were messing with it in the US. I think maybe the first tour might have been in France before stuff was popping here.
Right.
So you have these films. They're going to be shown on the first one will be shown on Revolt TV pretty soon.
Correct. Well, the first one was Cuba, which is airing on Revolt currently, and it's been airing. And then Peru, Coming Home Peru and Coming Home Haiti will be airing in the next few months.
That's really cool. And so it's interesting that you say you're not a filmmaker, because at this point you're someone who's made three films.
Right. I mean, I'll take the title now, but I still, I hate to say that because there's people that really that's their craft, and I don't want to take that. I'm just doing this because I just have a passion for hip hop in general, and I have a vision for what I want to do, and I'm just doing it. But yeah, there's a respect to the people that really do this. I'm seeing how hard it is.
Definitely. And the thing you really do is, is music, and you started out as a mixtape DJ, and you have a new album, Another Time, that is just out like last week. So it's a great record, first off. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the amount of people on it is astounding.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And, we'll talk about some of them and how they got there and stuff. But I wanted to start with literally the first voice you hear and the person who is on the tape more than any other artist, who is a good friend of the show, Umar Bin Hassan from The Last Poets.
EFN is not just another rare and unique personality. He has cut from another style, another genre, and another time.
Right.
How did he become involved?
That came through my business partner, Kether, who was very instrumental on the project. He helped, you know, he was there with me every step of the way. And we just, he had had some dealings with him, and he had brought it to my attention. He's like, what do you, would you like to have him involved in this project anyway? And I thought he was just a perfect addition to the project and fit the whole theme of another time. I mean, it took it to, really another time. My whole thing is, and this is like with mixtapes, and this project is supposed to embody what I was trying to do with mixtapes and what I think mixtapes should and could do, and which is mix it up and just have the old with the new and expose people to new things and put things that you would never, you know, imagine that they go together and make it sound good. And I just think that if I'm going to set off the project, you know, an intro by Umar is just like, to me, that, you know, that's really taking it to another time. And it was special to me. There's nothing else I could say.
You know, the thing about the album that stands out is exactly like you're talking about, the mixes, like you have different regions, you know, real, you know, cross focus on different regions and on different generations. Like you'll often have, you know, veterans mixed with new people on the same track.
Correct.
And so I wanted to talk about a couple of regions, specifically LA, which is, you know, where you were born and where you spent, you know, you were there, what, till you were like 10 or so, somewhere around there?
Yeah, I mean, my parents had separated when I was 5 years old, and my dad moved to Miami. So I had moved back and forth often when I was young. And I think, yeah, I finally stayed in Miami around 10. But I have family still in LA, and I travel back and forth. So I really feel connected to LA. LA is a part of you know, it's my roots.
What do you remember about the LA scene from, you know, when you were living there and kind of moving back and forth as a kid?
Well, when it comes to music and or hip hop specifically, I don't remember much of LA in terms of that. Mm. When it came to just music in general, that did have influence on me while in LA is my cousins, my older cousins that would listen to music and the stuff that they were listening to, which was a lot of disco, a lot of old school R&B stuff. And that's the type of stuff that had some influence on me and made me really get into music in general, like loving music. Because I love hip hop and hip hop culture, but I love all music. And but in terms of the LA hip hop scene or the music scene, I was too young to really, you know, get anything from it.
You know, with the people you have from LA on this tape, you know, there's Corrupt, who is a great choice, but not necessarily surprising. But you also go pretty deep. You know, you have Eight. You have King T, and you even have Cam, which I was K-A-M for anyone who thinks I'm talking about the New York guy.
Yeah.
Who I was super stoked to hear. My fam gon' eat, fuck an empty plate. Cam, DJ, EFN, Blue, and MCA. Only the streets can relate to the rhymes I state.
People say crime don't pay, but we say time don't wait. So just shine, don't hate, or hesitate. Right. This is the thing. When I was in high school in Miami, Miami had a huge influx of people from New York. And in the early 90s, in high school, you know, people, a lot of people might not be able to relate to this now, but in cities outside of New York and LA, I would imagine, hip hop was still like obscure. It was like new to people. We didn't have radio stations. We didn't have a lot of things going on within the, you know, hip hop wise in the city. So hip hop kids were like almost like gothic kids. They were small groups of people. And you could identify those people like, oh, those are the people into hip hop. And we kind of all knew each other in the city. It was like maybe a couple hundred of us total that were into this new thing called hip hop. And in Miami, most of those guys are from New York. But here I come, this guy that has LA roots. So I didn't, you know, the New York guys were really into the New York hip hop and they just couldn't hear anything else. There was nothing other than what was coming out of New York.
You know, it's so funny you say that. I just talked to someone not long ago who remembered in that era, you know, being so hardcore New York that he wouldn't even listen to rappers from New Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, I have my conspiracy theory, my theory that I say that New York is a reason why a lot of things went wrong in hip hop because they didn't open up early on, which could have, you know, helped out the culture as a whole. And then, you know, other regions took off and it kind of gave more power to different, you know, styles of music that maybe some of us aren't really into, meaning less lyrics is really where I'm going with that.
Sure.
So being that I was, you know, in from LA and I had those roots, I was the guy that I was always, you know, bringing to the table to my friends from New York or New Jersey or whatever. And I'm like saying, yeah, Karis One's dope, Kool G Rap's dope, but are you checking Compton's Most Wanted? You know, are you checking Above the Law? Like, you know, and I was bringing that to the table. And those were just, it was a part of me. And I wanted to, you know, and I brought that to my mixtapes. And I just, I like just hip hop from all regions. If I thought it was dope, it was going to, you know, it was something that I was going to try to expose to people. And I wasn't sticking to a formula that a lot of people were sticking to.
Yeah. And you also have a pretty heavy Detroit, Michigan presence on this record. You know, you have Black Milk and Guilty yep. Simpson and, you know, John Connor is not John from Connor. Detroit, but it's right. from Flint, and who I fucking love. I think he's great.
That same story, starving artist, been through the darkest parts of my life, trying to fight for this mic and they can't ignore me. The up downs and in my town had to duck rhymes, stressful for the limelight, get your mind right when the time's right, it'll test you, and what don't kill you, it'll make you stronger, look, believe that, and yeah, this life will whoop your ass sometimes, but we need that ego.
Yeah, no, he's super dope. We did a joint with him. I also co-managed the group Mayday and Recognize, and we did a remix on one of their projects that's on Strange Music, and we had John Connor on it.
Burn this bitch down. Starting up a revolution. Take it to a higher ground. Yes, yeah.
Television full of illusions here to confuse us while advertisers getting that paper. We getting stupid, and all the while we don't realize how gone the youth is. Transforced, they think they choose it. I see resistance is useless, and the truth is.
So I definitely want to work with him again.
What is it about the about kind of the Detroit scene, the Detroit aesthetic, that you wanted such a presence on the record?
I mean, it wasn't specific to Detroit. It was just fulfilling two things for me. It was, you know, were these artists fitting a criteria that I wanted for my project, which was, were they dope? Plain and simple. Did I like these artists? Did I think they were, you know, they were dope? And then if I could get somebody dope and from a different part of the country, then all the better for the project. I wanted to really shine the light on different regions and expose people from different places.
And one of the funnier, you know, more amusing parts on the record is you brought in one of our past guests, Milk D, to kind of reprise his top billing hook on one of your songs.
Milk is chilling. This is chilling. What more can I say? Top billing. That's what we get. Got it good since you understood. EFN's mixing. Milk is chilling. What more can I say? Top billing. That's what we get. Got it good. East rapping crazy.
Yeah, let me ask you, because I feel that you guys would know this. I personally don't think anybody's ever done what I did. Has anybody that you know of had asked him to do that?
Not that I can think of. I mean, obviously, tons of people have either sampled it right. or interpolated it using their own words.
Jay is chilling. Yay is chilling. What more can I say? We killing them. Hold up before we end this campaign.
DC chilling. PG chilling. My name Wale and I came to get it.
Fergie's chilling. Always illin. The way I make your sway, y'all feeling. That's how it is. Get down and jam. If y'all don't understand.
Doc is chilling, Jersey is chilling. What can I say? Fuck your feelings.
System dumping, dance floor jumping. We dirty deep in this bitch. We stunting, that's what you get. You in my hood. I thought you understood. You know me.
Correct.
But I don't think that anyone's gotten him to redo it that I can think of.
Yeah, my mind frame going into that, and I always wanted to do that, was, you know, coming from being around, you know, the sound Jamaican sound clashes is like, it's like having a basically a dub plate,
right?
And you know, and yeah, battling in a sound clash. Like, do you have this? You know, do you have this guy doing this? A dub plate, and boom, and that's what the idea for that was.
Yeah, that was a great moment. And kind of one more sort of specific thing about it. You have what to, you know, people who just kind of look at the track list, looks like a couple really odd pairings,
right.
And one that jumped out to me was having, you know, Juvenile and Trick Daddy. And then Dead Prez
right.
on the same song.
Yeah, this M1, a.k.a. M-A-O-L-U.
DJ EFN.
You know what I mean? Crazy Hood Productions. Beats in the hood right here.
Woo.
We surviving. Dead Prez. Juvie. Trick. Let's go.
It's called survival.
If you look at it, you're like, what do these guys have to do with each other? I mean, it sounds great. And when you think about it, you think, okay, well, Dead Prez has Florida roots and so forth. Like, if you go a
right.
little deeper, it makes sense. But just sort of staring at the track listing, the average fan might be a little confused.
Well, yeah, first and foremost, yeah. I met Dead Prez I think 95, 96 at a hip hop conference. And we immediately connected because they're from Tallahassee, Florida. So they are, in my eyes, they are a Southern group because of that. But it wasn't, that wasn't the reason behind it, is that Trick Daddy he's important to the Miami music scene. It might not be necessarily saying the hip hop scene, because there's, you have to be from Miami to kind of understand there's a dynamic between what people would consider hip hop at one point and then like the Miami bass scene, and Trick kind of comes from the Miami bass scene. But Trick is very respected within the city, musically. Like, and I mean, I would say, just to make it easy on people, hip hop wise. But I feel that he doesn't really get a lot of due respect outside of Miami. I don't think people consider him, like, really pay attention to his lyrics or think he's lyrical. But I've always really paid attention to what he's saying, and because he's from the city, it resonates with me, and it's real stuff, and he's really honest. And I've always wanted to do something with him and work with him and put him with another pair of artists that would kind of shine the light or expose him to a different group of people who never saw him in that light. And Dead Prez, I've always had the idea of putting Trick and Dead Prez together. That was always an idea I had. And then Juvie, to me, is just another underrated Southern lyricist that I don't think people give him the just that he deserves. I mean, some people do, but I just think overall he's not really considered like a lyricist. And I think he's a Southern lyricist, and he was actually the first person on the record, I already knew I wanted Trick and Dead Prez, and that's the way that record came about.
You raised the kind of difference between bass and you know, hip hop or rap or whatever in Miami. So when you moved, first settled in Miami, it was kind of like 86 or so, and
right,
basically the only thing going on at that point, which I don't even know if you were aware of because you were a kid, was bass.
No, definitely, it's a part. It's a part of Miami culture. I used to go to the skating rings and bass music. In the beginning, you would hear, you didn't know at first it was, oh, this is my bass music. Nobody went around saying this is bass music. It was just music that was being played, and it just happened to be local, but we didn't know it was a local thing when you're that young. It's just popular here. And as I got a little older, I started to realize, oh, this is Miami bass. This is born and bred music locally here. But what started to happen is, as I started to discover more and more of hip hop as a culture, because first I was exposed to rap music, and on one cassette I might have a song that has a Gucci Crew, you know, MC Shy D, Beastie Boys, Public Enemy, Dougie Fresh, you know, all on one tape, Run DMC. So to me, this was all the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as I got a little older, I started to see the divisions in the music. And as Luke started to progress even more, there was, you know, this division that this is bass music. And these cats were kind of like saying, nah, that hip hop stuff is, you know, it was like this New York thing. A lot of people would just pegged it off as, oh, that's that New York stuff. And part of that reason has to do with a lot of things, just because of the South just being the way it is, you know, segregated. If you would have talked to a kid in the hood, you know, in the inner city in Miami in the early 90s, he would have told you, like, if you asked him, do you listen to hip hop? He's like, I don't listen to that hip hop shit. You know, I listen to rap, gangster rap, or I listen to you know, Miami bass and NWA. I don't listen to none of that, you know, New York hip hop. And so it wasn't until commercial radio in Miami, and this is funny how things like this can affect the populace, but it wasn't until commercial radio started picking up that tagline that everybody else was picking up, saying where hip hop lives.
Mm-hmm.
Did like the everybody else in Miami, including the inner city, start to say, okay, this is all hip hop. But for the longest, bass music and even just gangster rap was always segregated to a lot of people in Miami's minds to hip hop.
So that was okay, but hip hop was this other kind of like.
Yeah, it was like this New York thing. Even if it wasn't from New York, if it didn't fit certain criteria for people, it was like, oh, that's that New York hip hop. You know, that we don't listen to that stuff.
So crazy. And, you know, you kind of have an homage to the hip hop scene in Miami with the song on the album Home Team.
drop scar. Trick daddy ran the yard, thought Trina was his bro, but my mother was superior. Daddy saw theory, bro. Bottom of the map, creepy sending my interior. 305
to the day that I die. Got my bully in the drive. Correct.
Yeah, and so those are, you know, some of the people on there are kind of like folks I'm assuming you knew back when you were starting with mixtapes.
Right. I mean, even before that, because, you know, once in high school, I started to realize that I really wanted to, you know, first as a fan, one thing about hip hop that drew me to it is that being someone that really loved music, I really liked how music was the soundtrack to generations. So you could think of historic events, and then there's like music that goes with it, because like just music was the soundtrack to the generations and to history. And I always, you know, looked up to that. And when you saw like movies about Vietnam, there was music and, you know, stuff from the, you know, the Frank Sinatra, and you could kind of like paint a picture of what that music of what that era felt like. And I felt hip hop was the music of my generation. So I wanted to get involved, and I felt like, wow, I'm experiencing something at its infancy, and this is special. So once I was realizing that, I was like, I want to be totally involved in this. So first, as a fan, I'm just wherever I can seek out hip hop events, I want to go, and I want to be not only instrumental in this music in general, but I know that in my city, it's even more at its infant stage. So I want to be heavily involved in it locally. So when I started going to these, you know, clubs, you know, which weren't many, like I told you, we kind of all knew each other by face that were involved in the scene. And Zulu Nation had a presence down here, and they would throw events. And once we would go to these things, there was people that were starting to rise up and kind of represent the scene. And one of those people was Mother Superior that I put on the project. So before I even started doing stuff, she was already had a name for herself out here as a fierce MC. And she was representing Miami lyrically, and just everything about her just was really representative of the Miami hip hop scene, which was at its infant stages. And we were just very proud of her back then, because we're like, she's holding the torch for Miami. She's not afraid to say Miami. She's lyrical. She's embodying just really good, great hip hop. And she's doing it on behalf of Miami. So that's what I wanted to do with Home Team. I wanted to give, you know, I had some of my artists that work with me, and then and some of the artists that were back in that scene, which was Mother Superior, Society, and Dynast. And then Scam is a friend of mine also that a lot of people know from working with Eminem and his artwork.
You probably hear this every day, but I'm your biggest fan. I even got the underground shit that you did with Scam. I got a...
Yo, I'm trying to be the man of the day. 365 a year. See the bullshit you saying, Scam ain't trying to hear. Busting lyrics in the air. Keeping some up in the chamber.
Yo, Scam, what the fuck you
man,
doing?
Man, I'm releasing
I'm trying to be the illest of the day. 365 a year. See the bullshit you saying, Shady ain't trying to hear. Spitting lyrics in your ear. Keeping some up in the chamber.
Hey, yo, Shady, what the fuck you doing?
I'm releasing anger.
You know, he did the Tribe Called Quest artwork. He's someone, he's from Miami as well, and I wanted to bring him on board for that track, and there you go, it's Home Team.
Yeah, and I heard an interview with you where you talked about how Mother Superior had an album that wasn't released that you thought really could have sort of changed the whole Miami hip-hop scene if it had come out when it was supposed to.
Without a doubt. She got signed, she did a record called The Rock Bottom, which basically was about Miami.
Heavy lyrics that move mountains, flow like fountains. Niggas better start counting before dismounting that horse. Verbal intercourse with no remorse. It's all up in the source, making sure it's reinforced.
And it was only played on pirate radio because we didn't have commercial radio playing hip hop yet. So it was played on pirate radio and college radio, and she got a deal off of that with Island Music. And that was huge for the scene. For someone like her to get a deal, and what happened was she did this album, and it was she had songs produced by Redman, she had tracks with KRS-One saying, you know, bigging up Miami, and she had all the top producers and, you know, a lot of top producers in the game on her project, and this is at, you know, at the height of these people's careers, and they're working on her project, so it was a huge album for that time period, and had that album come out, she ended up getting shelved by the label. Had that album come out, it would have really set the mark right there and put Miami on the map as this like hip hop powerhouse from that point on, and kind of would have, you know, influenced a whole generation of people in Miami. And just, I just think it would have been totally different scenes, at least sonically it would have been.
And, you know, around all that time was happening, you know, circa 93, you decide yourself to start making mixtapes at a point when no one in Miami was really doing that. Why'd you decide to do that?
Right. There was a couple of DJs that, you know, maybe did one mixtape or something like that. But I was, again, I was trying to find a way that I can impact and be a part of my scene and help develop the Miami hip hop scene. And I, you know, when I looked around, I was like, I could do it with mixtapes. This is something that I can actually do. It's inexpensive to get started. So that's what I did. I started to make mixtapes. And what was happening in Miami mixtape wise is that we were getting an influx of mixtapes from New York, you know, the DJ Clues, the SNSs, the Doo-Wops, the Tony Touches. And these mixtapes were coming in droves, and that's what everybody was listening to. So my goal was to give people in Miami the same quality and the same consistency that these guys were giving them, but sprinkle it with a touch of familiarity, which would be Miami. So it would have, you know, Miami themes in the mixtape, and it would expose some Miami artists. But at the same time, I'm giving you all the exclusives and the hot music you're getting from those guys, as well as the consistency and the quality of the mixtape. And that was my goal, and that's what set me apart from anybody else that was trying to do that at the time.
So how do you first do that? Like, you're like, oh, I want to get, you know, the exclusives, and I want to get the hot music and stuff that the Clues are getting and the Envies or whoever.
Right.
How do you do that, you know, not being in New York and not being tied into the industry?
Well, I definitely invested in myself. And what I did is I started to go to conventions to How Can I Be Down, which was a convention at that time, and I started to get drops from artists. So that might not seem like a big deal, but in that era, having a drop from Biggie or having a drop from Busta Rhymes, that was huge for someone in Miami. So that's one part of it. The other part is I would travel to record stores. I mean, I would jump in my car and go all the way to freaking New York and just to go record hunting. And I would get those white labels and come back to Miami and play these records. Or I would find these records that I know that, you know, maybe I'll be in New York when I'm looking for records and I'll pick up the new Clue or Tony Touch mixtape, and I could maybe get that white label at Beat Street. So even though I'm a little bit late, I'm still reaching the audience in Miami at the same time that those mixtapes are getting to us.
Right, because the mixtapes from New York have to physically travel down to Miami.
Right, before internet. So yeah, these mixtapes have to get to us. And even when they get here, it has to spread. So what I'm doing is I'm taking advantage. I'm local, so I'm getting all this stuff. I'm putting it in this mixtape, and I'm just hitting the streets running with it, making sure that you know that either I showed it to you first, you heard it first with me, or at the same time. That was my goal. And I have, you know, my team was massive. You know, it was like 10 to 15 in my Crazy Hood crew. And we were just like soldiers. We went out into the streets and we just worked. We hustled it. And as time progressed, the next goal from just getting drops and doing that was having artists do freestyles just like you were hearing on these New York mixtapes. Because that's the other thing that set them apart. They're like, oh, well, you know, if you're going to be a hot mixtape DJ, you got to have some exclusive freestyles from national artists, not just from local artists. I was doing the local artist thing, but I needed to really, you know, make a mark. I needed to have the national artist. And one of the first artists that really started showing me love was Nori.
That's my man, EF in the Crazy Hood. They only drink white liquor. So we're going to keep it on the white liquor tip. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, yo, so what's up? Your big mouth, big talk, big game. Look at your weak frame. Talk about your big chain. Set it on every radio station that I hit. We can fight one-on-one because I know you.
Nori, really, I have to give it to him. He's one of the first guys that really went in and gave me all these exclusives and freestyles, which we're friends to this day. We're really good friends. We're almost brothers. And all other artists started to take notice. And then also because, like I told you, there was no radio, no consistent mainstream radio or anything like that, my mixtapes became key to the industry. So artists, managers, A&Rs, record execs, they started to cater to me because I was one of the few outlets to expose their artists in Miami.
That's so interesting. Was there a moment, you know, when you first sort of started getting freestyles, getting exclusives, was there a moment you remember that you were like, this is it? Wow, I can't believe I got this. Like the first thing to really, really blow you away. in terms of like, you know, stuff that you had that no one else did?
I think the getting the first freestyle from Nori was pretty big to me. I opened up a store, a little clothing store, urban clothing store in my local area of Kendall in Miami called Crazy Goods. And we sold records and we sold hip hop gear and we sold graffiti stuff. And one of my boys that now he's the promoter of Live Sunday Live, which is one of the biggest, you know, hip hop parties in the world. He was one of the local promoters doing a lot of stuff, and I think they were promoting they had CNN, but Pone had, you know, was locked up. So Nori came alone. He was doing the press run by himself. And these guys would, you know, they would take the artists to wherever, like these little hip hop shops around the city to get the word out about the shows. And he brought Nori to my store, and me and Nori just clicked. And I was infamous for having this digital 4-track, and I would just put it in front of these artists, give them a microphone and headphones and be like, you need to give me a freestyle. And Nori was the first one, you know, because he was in my store and we were vibing. He was the first one to really put that 4-track to work for me. And he just gave me like 2 or 3 freestyles, which I already knew, like having that was going to just boom, set me apart locally from anybody else that was doing this. Like, that's it. Like, nobody was able to get something like this.
Yeah. And one of the craziest freestyles that you ever got, at least in terms of the situation and you got it, was from Redman on the set of Cisco Video.
Be high as fuck. Be high as fuck. Mixtape King in the house. High as fuck. Crazy hood management. High as fuck. Yo, I can flip burgers and be high as fuck. Cheeky eyes be fooling niggas, I'm sleep. Try your luck. When a barbed fire truck surround the scene, create chaos for project housing teams. Let's bet the 5 in the house. Have Baker lay your crew down like the guy on the couch. Once the song.
Yeah, Redman was that was very memorable because he, you know, again, I would take this 4-track anywhere. I had no shame. I was on my grind. So I would plop it in hotel lobbies, video shoots, didn't matter to me. And I would tell these artists, here you go. This is what you need to do. If you're an MC, you're going to do this for me. And Redman stepped up to the plate. Not only did he rhyme over the entire beat, which was like 3 or 4 minutes long, he's like, I want to do it over again. You know? And of course, I made sure to record both, and I have both of them. And I think he was high on X or something, and he mentioned it and he really did a freestyle, which was also, you know, not everybody did freestyles, real freestyles off the top. And he really was doing off the top freestyles, which was hilarious.
And to make it the freestyle by, you know, Redman while on X, even crazier, this was on the set of the Thong Song video, right?
On the set of the Thong Song video, where an ex-girlfriend of mine was doing her debut modeling, which was not cool, but yeah.
Amazing. So, you know, one of the things that you got to see being in Miami was, you know, artists come up who now have huge, you know, national presences. And I'm thinking specifically of, you know, Rick Ross and of Pitbull. Did you have any idea where did you first encounter both of those guys? Do you remember?
According to Pit, he says that he used to come to my store when he was really, really young and asked me for advice, and that I would, you know, give him all kinds of advice. I don't remember that specifically, but I do remember seeing him. I have an artist by the name of Garcia, and there was some battle going on that Luke, I think, was either one of the judges or one of the hosts or something. And the first time I saw Pitt was he was battling Garcia, and he lost to Garcia. And I think, if I'm not wrong, that's where he got discovered by Luke.
Luther, Uncle Luke Campbell, a.k.a. Luke Skywalker, began his career in the early 1980s as a key part of the ghetto-style DJs, a Miami-based crew that specialized in playing records with heavy, heavy bass, as was the style in the city since the beginning of their DJ scene in the late 1970s. Luke quickly became a key party promoter in the city and, in 1985, discovered a new group called 2 Live Crew. He created a record label, signed them, and moved them into a new, sexually explicit, bass-heavy direction with songs like Throw the D and We Want Some Pussy. 2 Live Crew's success was key to popularizing the Miami bass sound. As Roni Sarig put it in his book, Third Coast, Outkast, Timbaland, and How Hip-Hop Became a Southern Thing, Two Live Crew led the genre's charge into the national consciousness. By 1992, the group had fallen apart amid controversy and legal wrangling over their explicit lyrics, and much of Luke's efforts were put into his label Luke Records, which signed a young Pitbull in 2001.
So that's the first time I saw Pitt, and then shortly after that, some of the first times that people heard Pitt on a pretty outside of his crew of people was on my mixtape.
Y'all already know who it is and y'all already know what I bring. Let me show you how true it is, M-I-A-M-I in this bitch. For those that don't know, this is Pitbull. When them K's get a ripping, hope the goddamn shits don't hit you. Crazy hood and your phantom boys been grinding. Pitbull, Big Teach, them boys been grinding. Cubo, just keep riding. It's perfect time and skip on through and come back at nine.
You know, I started to put them on my mixtapes. And the same thing with Ross. Ross was somebody that was doing some stuff, but again, you know, I was tapped into the local scene. I was about exposing local artists, and one of the first times that a lot of people heard Ross was on my mixtapes as well.
It's Rick Ross and Recognize. We breaking records now. Watch our little records rise. In record time, I can't recognize. Fuck slipping slide, they holding back a check of mine. I'm on some nigga shit, tried to go legitimate. Now I want to tank with a lot of shit to fill it with. One time for EFN, we the men, the A-O-D-O-N.
Interesting. So I think now, just because Pitbull has such a big kind of national presence and is someone who's on pop records, people don't necessarily remember that he came up through Luke Campbell of Two Live Crew.
Uncle Luke, Do you have any lollipops for me to lick?
Pitbull, you bum, let's get him. I'm from the bottom, so everything I do is dirty. If I pull up in the drop, it's dirty. The way I pound that thing is dirty. Boot treat my thing like a 450. Don't pull it down unless you blow it. Come on, mama.
Yeah, he was signed to Luke Records, and he toured with Luke and everything. He definitely has been grinding for a very long time.
What about Rick Ross?
Another dude that really put in a lot of work. He had been signed to Slip and Slide Records, which was also the home of Trina and Trick Daddy. He was signed there for a while. He was writing records for people, and he wasn't specifically getting. They weren't focusing on him, so he started to put out a series of mixtapes with another friend of mine, DJ Megamix. And Megamix was the one that brought him to my attention to get him on my mixtapes. And again, he's just someone that he really hustled and grind to where he's at now. Like, I respect the grind. Both of those guys has been amazing. They both work for what they have right now. Definitely worked.
Did you envision, you know, when you first kind of ran across them, that they would end up, you know, anywhere near where they are?
Yeah, it's hard to envision that, to be quite honest with you. Mm-hmm. You just run into so many artists, you don't know who's going to do what. But one thing I have learned over the years is that regardless of what you think about somebody's music, if someone has a drive, they can get to where they want to get if they just keep going. And that's the thing that I've seen in both of those guys, specifically Pitbull more than anything. His drive was just uncanny, man. Like, this dude was a workhorse. And he had a vision, and he was going for it at all costs. People did not respect him at first. People were not respecting him. And you know, now people don't, you know, hip-hop-wise, people don't have much respect for him. But this guy is an international, like, powerhouse now. Like, it doesn't matter, you know, for him, for what he wants, he's a huge success.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about people who sort of cross over in that pop way, people like a Pitbull or a Will.i.am, is, like, they are, you know, they may do pop records, but like they have serious hip hop bona fides, which is not something people think about unless you're really in the scene.
Right. Right. Yeah. They think that they just popped up and went pop.
Right.
No.
Right.
These guys have hip hop roots. They are a part of hip hop culture and history. Whether, you know, they went into another direction later in their careers, that's another thing. Whether you like the music or not, that's another thing. But if you do the research on these guys, they pay their dues just like any other hip hop artist that you love.
Yeah. I mean, I think of this, you know, specifically with Will.i.am, you know, signed to Eazy-E as a teenager. He still can freestyle and b-boy like nobody's business when he wants to.
Yeah.
You know, but he does pop records, and I assume, you know, comparable things are true of Pitbull.
Most definitely.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about this album, About Another Time, about your role. I think people are used to thinking of mixtape DJs when they are mixtapes, you know, when they're doing mixtapes as, you know, curators. But with retail albums, maybe it's a little different in a sense. You know, like, people might be a little confused in that, like, your name is on the album, but you know, you didn't produce the beats and you're not rapping on it. So, like, what was your role on the record?
I mean, the word that you use is curation. That's like the ultra A&R. I had a vision of who I wanted on this, and I approached it just like I approached my mixtapes. You know, you bought a DJ EFM mixtape or you had a DJ EFM mixtape, you bought into the DJ, whatever mixtape DJ you got, you bought into the DJ, you were gonna, you know, you just respected whatever they were gonna give you, and usually, you know, you're like, okay, if EFN said it's good, you know, he's a tastemaker, I'm gonna pay attention to it, or I'm gonna listen to it at least, and that's what I wanted to do with the project. I wanted to give you the same musical morals that I was trying to do with the mixtapes and the mixtape culture that I grew up in, which is basically give you some pioneers, legends, people that are well established in hip hop, the guys, young guys that are buzzing, that are hot, and also expose you to brand new talent you may not have heard of, and make sure that I sprinkle it with Miami flavor as well to let you know where I come from. And I, you know, I, of course, I didn't produce, I'm not rapping, but I feel like it's just as much work curating. You know, it's a form of production. Let's not forget, you know, producing isn't just physically making a beat. Producing is putting things together. And that's what I did here.
Mm-hmm. And where did the song concepts come from? Like, presumably you give a song to an artist and say, hey, it's called this, you know, this is more or less what I want you to write about. Like, where did that stuff come from?
Each song has its own story. When I got the, you know, first I picked out all the production, all the beats. And then I started to envision the artists I wanted on these. So I made a fictitious track listing, you know, like a wish list of, okay, these are the songs. These are tentative names for each song. This is the feel that I'm getting from the song. So these are the artists that I envision would sound good on the song.
And how close was that tentative list, by the way, to the end product?
I would say we came 90% close.
Wow.
And I actually posted the original board with the track listing on my Instagram, and you can see, and I crossed out artists that didn't make the track,
mm-hmm.
and then the artists that I replaced them with, and you could see, yeah, we came 90% close, so I'm pretty proud of that.
That's really incredible.
Yeah.
And one of the unique things about your career is, like, you've been very versatile, right? Like, you have the film thing that's new, like, you have mixtapes, you said you worked at a clothing store. You do management, you've done, you know, even like kind of street team marketing stuff.
Yeah, I have a marketing company, yep.
Yeah. So how did you make the move from being like, oh, I'm a fan, oh, maybe I'm going to do some mixtapes, into these other businesses?
Whatever came natural to me. I mean, I definitely feel that if you're going to survive, and I think art as a passion, most people are not going to make money off of it. They're not going to be able to live off of it. So I feel that if you want to do your passion, you have to supplement it with other things and try to supplement it with things that are relatable to that art. So that's all I did. So if something came natural to me, if I felt that I had a knack for it and it helped, you know, it was still in line with what I'm doing, then I went ahead and did it if I found a lane into that. So whatever just came natural. I don't force things. I'm not a person that likes to force things. If the vibe isn't right, no matter, you know, that might sound corny, but if I don't feel the vibe, I don't do it. I'm really into how I feel about things, and I really feel that if it feels right, just do it. And a lot of these things basically almost just fell in my lap, or I just envisioned, okay, I can see myself doing this. This could work, and we can do this and this, and it relates to this way. Boom, let's do it.
Another one thing you've done is websites, right? You have Crazy Hood.
Yeah, our site was one of the first hip-hop related sites locally in Miami. I started crazyhood.com in 94.
Wow. And so, you know,
beat myself up about that, because I wish that I would have really dove deeper into the cyber world and learning it, because I feel like I'm still playing catch up now. When I had a site in 94, I should have been ahead of the game now.
And what kind of, you know, you do a bunch of stuff. Like, I've even written some things for it in the interest of full disclosure, but like, what's your vision for it? Like, what do you see it sort of covering doing?
I mean, right now it's just basically a blog and a destination where people could find out what we're doing as a company, but also the things that we're into. We showcase artists we're into outside of our own artist and outside of our company, and just things that I'm interested in. So it's just a destination for our company where you could just find out about us and things that we're interested in. As of right now, that's all it is.
Mm-hmm. And you have another site that is in its early stages, 90shiphop.com.
Correct.
Yeah. Right. So what is that, and where do you see that going?
90s hip hop has been something that I had brainstormed for a while. And then a friend of mine that also had worked on one of our websites, crazy, like one of the crazyhood.coms, he had built it at one time for us. He had thought of the same idea separately. So when we both spoke about it, we're like, oh, we both have the same idea. And we partnered up on it. And basically, my idea for 90shiphop.com is I kind of would like it to be like the Wikipedia of 90s hip hop, be interactive. It's user generated information. And that's, I just want it to be, yeah, something that's interactive. People go in there and submit links of their favorite stuff. And eventually what I would love is just like here in Miami, how we have a local, you know, like a local history and a local scene that people don't know about. And sometimes even the locals don't even know about it. It would be great if every region and every city can start inputting, you know, stuff from their local area. Like, I don't know who the pioneer of like the Denver hip hop scene is. You know, it'd be cool if they can start to curate it and put stuff in there and have a pride in their city in this destination, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, winding down, one of the things that you've been talking about lately is how the mixtape scene, as you kind of pioneered it, has changed, and it's being replaced by blogs, and sort of the whole concept of what an exclusive is changing so rapidly. I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, actually, I was going to bring that up when we started talking about my site. I definitely have a strong opinion that mixtape culture, at least the one that I came up in, no longer exists. I don't think we can go back to that, A, because of technology alone. And it's just it just doesn't exist anymore. The way that we would get exclusives, the freestyles, the leaks, you know, at one point it was dat tapes, all that is gone. So I feel that now the blog and the bloggers and the websites have replaced the mixtape DJ, or what we did for the audience, in terms of now, instead of picking up the mixtape to hear who's hot, who's buzzing in the streets, you know, the new track from so-and-so that just leaked, you just go every day online, and these different blogs and websites are going to provide that for you. And they're going to curate their blog and mix and website to give you certain artists that they think are dope, just like a mixtape DJ would.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I certainly remember, you know, the mixtapes kind of moving from a more retail thing where it was, you know, $5 a pop, $10 a pop or whatever, to being, you know, concentrated on certain websites, and now you're saying, right, even that is kind of fading out.
Yeah, I just think, I mean, I know that people are still putting out mixtapes and digitally. I just think that the power that we held as mixtape DJs and what we did for the audience, it's gone for me. Mm-hmm. I don't think that exists anymore. I don't think people are going now and saying, I better check if so-and-so put out a mixtape on whatever website to find out who the new artist is. They're not doing that anymore. They're just going directly to, you know, these different sites and just seeing what they're posting for the day is. And, oh, look, the new song from this guy or the new video from this dude. The thing now that I think is mixtapes to a lot of the newer generation is a mixtape to them is an artist rapping on other people's beats and putting out a pseudo project, an album, and calling it a mixtape.
The sort of like post 50 Cent model or whatever.
Exactly. That's what, if you were to ask someone, you know, maybe under the age of 30, you know, that's what a mixtape to them is, probably.
Right. And, you know, one of the reasons in, you know, in addition to just kind of the march of technology, that the mixtape world ran into problems was legal stuff. You know, there was obviously the bust with Drama.
Fulton County SWAT team and officers from Clayton County raided DJ Drama's Gangsta Grill's recording studio last night. Among the items seized, 50,000 counterfeit CDs, recording equipment, computers, cars, cash, and bank statements. The two work at Hot 107.9.
Right.
There was something that happened a little closer to you in Miami as well,
yeah.
Right?
Hip Hop Connection was one of the biggest mixtape distributors in the country, if not internationally. And yeah, he got raided by the feds. I mean, he got physically raided by the feds.
Wow. And so the weird thing about that is so many of the exclusives and stuff that you had, you know, supposedly, you know, where the legality was a little gray, you guys were often getting that directly from the people who owned it, right? From the record labels.
Oh, most definitely. But then they would turn a blind eye whenever the authorities came into play, which was sad. Sad for the culture. Mm-hmm. It's funny because I had this lawyer in the mid-90s or to late 90s. He was like Gloria Estefan's lawyer or something like that. And he's a big lawyer. And I remember I was telling him about what I was doing. His eyes just got so wide. He's like, you need to stop doing that immediately. And I remember just like telling him like, nah, this is a part of hip hop. This is what we do. He's like, you're stealing people's music. What are you doing? He was just like, he could not fathom what a mixtape was and what it was to the culture. And I'm like, nah, man, like I'm going to keep doing it. And I caught some heat, some legal heat a couple times, but thankfully I didn't get anything too crazy, but I did catch heat a couple times. There was a distributor out of Texas, I forget their names, that they were basically taking all of our mixtapes, changing the names on the cover and making it whatever the artist hosting it was, and making it seem like it was their album. And I caught a couple, some heat off of some of those that they put out that they did that. I didn't do it.
Right. And so you're not still making mixtapes anymore in the way you were, right?
Not at all. No.
Yeah.
I lost. Yeah. I don't have a passion for it because I just don't think that culture exists anymore.
Well, I guess, you know, winding down, I really love the record.
Thank you.
And the cover is also super noteworthy. The cover kind of has a story behind it, right?
Yeah, most definitely. And I want to talk about this because we've been catching a little bit of heat from hip hop fans out there thinking that we got a little too influenced by MF Doom. But that character, which was created by Scam, which I mentioned before, he did a Slim Shady LP artwork, Tribe Called Quest, Beats, Rhyme, and Life, and he did a bunch of other stuff. Those are just the two most notable. And he's also the guy mentioned in the song Stan. We created that character together, which I call that character Norm. And I would say we did it the same year or before MF Doom started pushing the MF Doom character. You know, as I know that's a comic character, but before him pushing it, you know, as his kind of like mascot.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't even heard that. People are saying, oh, you have this guy with a sort of hockey mask face guy.
People on the blogs and then Snoop, he posted the artwork because it has his first album cover in the artwork. So he had posted it and, you know, he gets tons of views. So people were saying that in there and people keep telling me, oh, people think you jacked MF Doom. And I'm like, listen, man, that character was conceived around the same time, maybe even before MF Doom did it, you know, but it's a character that we thought of without any influence. And it's a guy that basically was, you know, put in an insane asylum. And he's in a straitjacket, and that's in the specific artwork for my album is actually a series of pieces that Scam had been doing from our first project that came out in the late 90s, early 2000, from this group called The Alliance that we put out. And it was the first introduction of this character in a straitjacket in a padded room. And we're basically telling you his story in the physical, when you buy a physical copy, like on vinyl or whatever. And I'll put this online. We're going to tell you kind of like a little mini comic strip story about how this guy became crazy. And this is him in one of our previous albums. He escaped the insane asylum and he goes back home to his old room. And this is his room as he left it when he got institutionalized. And he's just realizing like, damn, like he didn't realize all this time had passed. He basically missed out on the scene. And the albums and everything on the floor is what's left over from when he got taken away. And the calendar, which is another thing that fans have been picking up on, they swear that I was trying to say that all these albums came out in May of 93, which that's not what I was trying to say.
Of course, yeah.
Which is insane. May of 93 is the exact month and year that I established Crazy Hood Productions. And that's why that calendar has that date on it.
Yeah, it's funny that, you know, I hadn't even thought of Doom. Like the closest sort of analog I can think to a character like Norm is something like Eddie from Iron Maiden, who's just, you know.
That's a huge inspiration, actually. I'm a huge fan of Eddie from Iron Maiden. And that's why I wanted to come up with a similar mascot for myself, because I've always loved Eddie from Iron Maiden.
Nice. Awesome. Well, you know, another time, super great record. Again, way, way more artists on here than we can even, you know, begin to speak about, including tons who have been guests on the show, including another Florida guy, Eric Biddens.
Dope. Yeah, he's really dope.
Yeah. And I was so glad to hear him on a song with Bun B. I just thought it made a lot of sense.
You can break out of the crazy hood that you left in. Wise words from the OG and EFN, baby.
Yeah, no, and Bun, and another thing I like to note is that a lot of these guys on this project were actually, you know, friends of mine throughout the years that I've worked with on mixtapes. That was another big component of this. That I couldn't do this a project like this without having real relationships that were going to come through for me, because financially I wouldn't have been able to do this if there was any other, you know, situation that I would. So yeah, that's a big part of it, and that's something else that I like to express to people, like, as they're going, if they're trying to be involved in this industry, like, cultivate relationships, real relationships, because it's worth more than money.
Yeah. And one final thing, you and your company are shouted out, you know, a ton of times on the record. Was there any particular shout out that you really love that maybe was your favorite?
The most special shout out for me is the cuts that I asked Premier to do.
DJ EFN. Crazy Hood Productions, putting it down straight like that. Who's crazy?
Which I presented him with cuts, vocals that Guru had done for me when he had hosted and done some freestyles on some mixtapes of mine. And the idea was, if I ever worked with Premier, I was going to present these vocals and ask him to cut these vocals up for me for a hook. And he obliged, and that was incredibly special to me. And then to have, the way I look at it is that, again, since I'm not an artist, and this is basically me trying to express myself through other artists and other people, and also branding myself as well. What's the ultimate hip hop branding? But to have Premier make a beat and then cut up vocals of the late Guru saying Crazy Hood Productions and EFN, doesn't get any better in hip hop branding than that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your time, and
you.
For another time. And thanks so much.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you for having me.
It's not often in hip hop or anywhere else that you get to talk to someone who single-handedly started a whole scene. That was the case here with EFN and Miami Mixtapes. As you heard in the interview, he had to drive up to New York by himself to get the white labels to put on the mixtapes that would get the whole thing started. I also learned a lot from him about the origins of the hip hop scene in Miami, the ways in which Miami bass and more traditional hip hop were at odds, interacted, and eventually merged. It's also good to get the full context of Pitbull's rise into a white-suited international pop star. EFN's theories about hip-hop are well thought out and really interesting. The role that New York City played in limiting hip-hop's growth, why mixtape culture as we know it is dead, how a single album not being released changed the history of Miami's whole hip-hop scene. We could have talked for hours just about those ideas. And of course, I loved hearing about his burgeoning career as a documentarian. We know a lot about the club scene in New York and even the club scene in Miami, but not much about what's going on in Lima. Make sure to check out his new album another time. Next week, we talk to noted author and critic Oliver Wang about his new book, Legions of Boom, Filipino-American Mobile DJ Crews in the San Francisco Bay Area. In addition to this book, Oliver is also the editor of Classic Material, the Hip Hop Album Guide. And most hip hop fans will be familiar with his writing in Wax Poetics, Vibe, The Village Voice, The LA Times, NPR, and more. We'll talk about all that and his beef with Cypher guest number one, Gene Gray. You can find The Cypher on Twitter,
Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this week's show, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. You can find us online at thecyphershow.com. And make sure to support the show at patreon.com/thecyphershow. And once again, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
He doesn't really get a lot of due respect outside of Miami.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
This is something that I can actually do. It's inexpensive to get started.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
I was on my grind, so I would plop it in hotel lobbies, video shoots, didn't matter to me.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
And you could hear those, when I talk about the drops, getting the drops, you'll hear the progression from the first mixtapes just having drops and records to the Nori freestyle. And then you start to see me getting more freestyles and then the Redman one and all of that. And you'll hear the first time Pitbull was on the mixtapes and Rick Ross and all of that.
Somebody say, hey, we want some pussy. Hey, we want some pussy. You see, me and my homies like to play this game. We call it Amtrak, but some call it the train. We would all line up in a single file line and take our turns at waxing girls' behinds. But every time it came to me, I was shit out of luck because I'd stick my dick in and it would get stuck. The girls would say, stop. I'd say, I'm not. That's enough. I quit because y'all are busting me out. I say, girls, don't hide it. Just divide it. And so please don't knock it until you've tried it. So to all of you bitches and all you hoes, let's have group sex and do the Rambo.